Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. The National Park System celebrated its centennial in 2016. The now 60 officially designated national parks span the country with a diversity of natural and human history, along with land and timescapes that have been called the best idea we ever had by writer Wallace Stegner. In 2013, Carla K. Morton, one of the Texas Poet Laureates, was inspired to tour all of the parks and share her experiences through the lens of poetry. She invited her fellow Poet Laureate, Alan Birkelbach, along for the journey, and he said yes without hesitation. The pair of poets are about halfway through their tour of the parks, producing poems, photographs, and experiences that they hope to share with all of us. We caught up with Morton and Birkelbach while they were visiting Yosemite National Park in Central California as a massive wildfire raged just south of the park. They had planned to join us via Skype from their hotel in Mammoth Lakes, California, but had to go to Plan B from a cafe in the resort town when the hotel's Wi-Fi went out. So you may hear a bit of background noise from the restaurant, but actually, I really enjoyed that aspect of it as I imagined sitting there with two poets over lunch in the beautiful Eastern Sierra Nevada community that's the gateway to the park. So join us as we talk parks and poetry with Carla Morton and Alan Birkelbach. Carla and Alan, welcome to Blue Dot. I'd like to start out with a bit of background. How did you become a person of letters, someone who loves writing and poetry?
Well, I was just always that very strange kid out in the back with a piece of paper and a pen and just sitting there. I knew at an early age, if I could just pay attention to the world, to the universe, to the wind, and listen hard enough, it would have something to tell me. And so I just, you know, that's kind of where it all began. I just, and I still feel that way. If I could just listen hard enough, I will be given some kind of revelation or insight. Maybe this is how other artists feel.
Carla, I'd like to know, what the heck does it mean, really, to be a poet laureate? Because I know what a Nobel laureate is. That's when you win the Nobel Prize. So what's a poet laureate?
Well, a poet laureate is actually the highest rank you can go in a state or a country or a nation in poetry. Now, does that mean in all of that state or that area that you are the best? Maybe not, because there are incredible poets everywhere. But it's an incredible honor and title. And in Texas, they have had a poet laureate since 1932. It's really a long-running state to have a laureate. And whereas many places it's a paid position, it's never been a paid position in Texas. But the trade-off is you have the title for life. So that's kind of cool. Though I really like how they do it in England. They pay their laureates in half money, half cask of sherry. I think that's a grand idea.
And how do you become chosen as a poet laureate?
Well, I can speak for the way Texas does it. And every 2 years, they have a call for nominations for poet laureate and for state musician, state two-dimensional artist, and state three-dimensional artist. Those were added relatively recently in the whole state of Texas history. And then all of these great numbers of names go to the TCA, the Texas Commission of the Arts in Austin. And they whittle it down. They have a long criteria of publishings and, you know, things that you must meet that criteria. And then out of that great group, they whittle it down to a group of up to 10 people. And then the governor, lieutenant governor, the Texas House, the TCA, they have people who are educated in letters spread out around the state, and they're anonymous. They are kept anonymous, so you can't call and say, hey, pick me, pick me. And this group of unknown people pick the next laureates, and they name them, since the legislature meets every 2 years, they name them for the next 2 years.
Well, we're going to talk about words of preservation, the Poets Laureate National Parks Tour in a moment, but obviously to me that if you're doing a national parks tour and you love nature, are there misconceptions that you think people outside of Texas have about Texans' connections to nature?
Oh yes, they expect. I think they expect people from Texas to only be able to talk about certain things like, you know, cattle and windmills, which, you know, as any poet you start with what you know, right? You know, this is a kind of in defense of regionalism. You have around you what you know, and you start writing from there. But the key in poetry is to take that and make it a universal thought or feeling that everyone can relate to. But yeah, I do think there is a little bit of a bias against Texas poets, because they think, oh, they're just, you know, just a one song person. But that's really short-sighted. There are incredible, incredible poets, not just in Texas, but everywhere. The Southwest, the East, the West, all areas have their amazing people.
It's interesting you mentioned regionalism, because I'm reading a book about Edward Abbey and Wallace Stegner. And one of the things that always bothered them was being pigeonholed as regional writers. And of course, they're two of the great nature writers of the West. And I had loved a quotation by Abbey, as some New Yorker was saying, well, the problem with you is you're a big fish in a small pond. And he's like, well, how ironic is that to say that New York is a small pond and the great American West is not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, and it doesn't matter what your theme is, if or where you are, if you touch the hearts and the minds of not only people that hear you, but people that read you as well. Because, you know, poetry has two life forms. It's what's written on the page and what is heard, because it was originally an oral art form. And so how it's heard is just as important, I believe.
Well, tell us about the tour that you're doing. My understanding is that in 2016, the centennial of the National Park System, you came up with the idea that you would like to go see all of them. Is that right?
Yes, the idea actually became planted in my head in 2013. I was at a meeting and I believe it was in Dallas, and someone was talking about how 2016 would be the 100th anniversary of the national parks. And honestly, I didn't hear another thing that the speaker said, how sad, but my mind just jumped and I went, oh, okay, this is a world that has inspired me so much. Something has to be done. It has to be celebrated in such a grand way. So I started researching it, and not since the time of Emerson and Thoreau and John Muir has a body of literature been written specifically to help culturally preserve the parks, and not really in poetry. I mean, the individual poets have done it, but not as a group for the parks to help culturally preserve it. And I thought, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to all of the parks. There were 59 at the time. There's 60 now, all the national parks. And now there are over 400 national battlefields, rivers, forests, everything else. But I'm concentrating just on the national parks, and there's 60. I'm going to go to all of them. I'm going to write poems, take photos, and with a percentage of proceeds from the forthcoming book can go back to the national park system. And I thought, well, what's more historic than one poet laureate be for two? So I asked Alan Berkelbach, fellow Texas poet laureate, and my best friend, and I said, hey, this is what I'm going to do. Do you want to do it with me? And then about 30 seconds, he's like, oh yeah, I'm on board. So the idea began. I tried for years trying to, and I still tried for funding and grants and that type of thing. And I have not been able to acquire any, but I'm still trying. But we thought, okay, this idea is too important, and we're just going to just start doing it. So we're doing it on our own nickel. And we started June 2016. We started at the park that was first named Yellowstone. And And then right now we're in Yosemite. We're talking to Yosemite, and this is park number 28 on the tour.
Wow, so you're almost halfway.
Yes, we've got them planned every month through the end of 2019. And then hopefully we do have a publisher that's interested in looking at it already. So hopefully the book will be published in 2020. So that's the goal.
For you, you mentioned that this, you know, kind of the light bulb went off for you listening to this talk in Dallas. I'm curious, what was your, you know, you obviously had a love over the national park system, or that wouldn't have happened. What was your first experience with a national park as a child, or whatever that was?
Well, as a child, my family did not really travel to the national parks, and I always wanted to go there. We went to Carlsbad Caverns, and I absolutely love that. But that was really the only park that I had been to. I took my kids to Grand Canyon probably 15 years ago, but I knew that this was a love of mine. I've always had that need, that urge to go there, and once you see them and once you're out in them, you realize this is, at least for me, this is what it's all about. The great need, you know, we protect what we love, and I have this great love of the parks, and so I have had this great need to preserve and protect it, and 'cause you know, when we save what's sacred, we save ourselves.
That's beautiful, which I would expect coming from you. So you've gone to all these parks, and of course, you know, the cliche question would be to ask you what's your favorite park, but I'm not going to do that. I have some other ways to approach it. Yeah, well, that's why I'm not going there. But I'd like to know, as far as what's the closest park to where you live that you've visited?
To where I live, the closest park to where I live would probably, well, let's see. In Texas, there are two parks. There's Guadalupe Mountain and there's Big Bend. But where I am in Texas, in Fort Worth, probably Hot Springs, Arkansas would be the closest, just in miles, and which is a very wonderful park, completely, almost a completely urban park and fascinating in its own right.
And had you visited those parks that are closest to you much before this tour?
I had not. I believe when I was a kid, we drove through Hot Springs, but no, I really hadn't. So this is, you know, I think just one day I woke up an explorer and I said, this is something I have to do. And I would love to say that I'm following in the footsteps of John Muir and Lewis and Clark and Sacagawea, but I don't know if I can, you know, be so grand as to say that. I just feel like that poetry can save the world, and if any way it can help save our national parks and protect them.
Well, you've visited so many of the parks now. Could you just kind of give us a list of some of the highlights of some of the parks you've visited? Maybe not all 29, but you mentioned Yosemite, and of course the fire has been burning there. Did that really affect your visit?
Well, yes, we are here now, and the fire is on the western side. I don't believe it's only like 7% contained. It's not well contained at all, and it's wildfire. And on the western side, the Yosemite Valley is very smoky. But we went earlier in the week down there, and Yosemite is huge. It takes us about 2.5 hours just to get from one side of the park to the other. But no, it really has not hindered us at all. We have found amazing areas. We just went up to Hetch Hetchy in the northern section. And I don't know if you recall the history of Hetch Hetchy, but John Muir did his best to keep the Tuolumne River pristine and not dammed. But it it was damned anyway. And I know that was a heartbreak for John Muir. So we had to go up there. It's still absolutely gorgeous, of course. And I know the reservoir provides much needed water to the San Francisco area, but it breaks my heart that they would do that, especially after a park is named a park. Promises like that should stay, you know.
Yeah,
we have to keep our promises, not just to humanity, but to the earth.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll continue our conversation with Texas Poets Laureate Carla K. Morton and Alan Berkelbach as they tour our national parks. Stay with us. We're back. Let's rejoin our interview with Texas Poets Laureate Carla K. Morton and Alan Berkelbach. They joined us via Skype from Mammoth Lakes, California, while visiting Yosemite National Park on their tour of all of America's crown jewels, our national parks. I'm going to just do a little word game with you, okay? So I'm going to just give you a word, and I want you to tell me about a park or an experience that comes to mind when I mention that word. Just whatever pops into your head first, okay?
Okay.
Okay, so first one up, solitude.
Nevada Great Basin. I believe that's probably the most quiet I have ever been in my entire life. It was incredible.
Solitude? A Great Basin, absolutely. Great Basin is the park on that. We spent one of the evenings at one of the archaeological dig sites just outside the park. Literally within a mile or two of the boundaries of the park is this huge open field. There was almost no human lights at all out there, and it was a sky full of stars, and there was no other sound. There was nothing out there, and it was incredibly beautiful and calming. It was almost like a healing evening because everything else dropped away. We didn't have to worry about anything else except the totals, you know, the voices, the music of the spheres that was calling down to us. It was incredible.
Yes, and you know, the national parks are one of the places where there are things they preserve that we don't think about. For example, the dark night sky is something that is preserved in the national parks, like Yosemite. Lassen Volcanic National Park has a dark sky festival to celebrate that. Death Valley has one of the darkest skies. And of course, also quiet. And it's something we don't think of. We think of preserving wildlife and trees and lakes and those pristine landscapes. But also the natural quiet is something that is preserved in the parks.
That is so true. It's the quiet of and to experience nature the way that it was created. That's huge.
Okay, next word. Ready?
Yes.
Adventure.
Adventure. I would say Yellowstone. To walk among the boiling pots of mud, to actually see the earth come up like that and know that it's boiling and that there is a whole caldera, there is a whole chaos underneath us, and that our lives are just such a short time in this big huge world, and yet we step delicately through life, even through boiling pots of mud.
Yes, Yellowstone's amazing, and it's so big, and there's so much to it. So you can always go back to it if you want to on one of these.
Absolutely.
Ready for the next one?
Yes.
Majesty, as in Purple Mountains.
That would be Glacier National Park. Okay, I must say Glacier National Park. Now I've only been to 28, but it's the first place that made me cry.
Wow. How so?
The majesty was deep blue and rugged, and there was a beauty there that is similar to the wide openness of Alaska, and it's gorgeous and fierce at the same time.
Majesty. When it comes to majesty, I've got to go with Zion National Park in Utah. There is no other park in my measurement so far that is anything like Zion. It's towering walls of pink and white and yellow that wrap around a valley that's deep and narrow. It doesn't entirely block out the sun, so the sun will just come up over the edge and light up these huge pink walls, full of waterfalls and narrow rivers. It's not a quiet park so much, and it's a very well-visited park, but the incredible beauty and these giant pink monoliths that just stare down at you, it takes your breath away.
Okay, ready for another word?
Ready for another word?
Mystery.
Mystery. You know, there are a few parks that we left with more questions than we arrived with. Mesa Verde is a big mystery for me, and nearby, just still part of it, but officially over the edge of the national park boundary, is Hovenweep. Still part of the Mesa Verde area and mystery. Oh yes, that place whispers in ghosts. I just haven't figured out what they're telling me yet.
It's the ancient Anasazi civilization that disappeared from there.
Absolutely, absolutely. And they left us so many clues, and we have lost the ability to figure out what they were telling us.
When it comes to mystery, there are some of the parks that we've been into that we come out with more questions than we went in with. And the mysteries, the biggest one I have is Dry Tortugas down in Florida. It's a smaller park. You have to take a ferry boat out to it, and it's a fort. And our biggest question was, why is this a national park and not a monument? Because it's truly an old military fort from the Civil War era. But there are so many historical connections. The biggest one we had was, why did they start getting funding for the fort? If it was meant to be for the Civil War, why did they start getting funding for it 10 years before the Civil War started? And then what's the connection with the sinking of the Maine and Cuba, which happened several years later? It's almost like there are too many interconnected historical pieces for them to just have this huge fort out there that they only used for a few years. So we came away with a whole lot more questions at that park than we did. Big mysteries at that one.
And any parks that, like, maybe for all kinds of interesting historical reasons where it's just the stories of the place appealed to you?
Oh, absolutely. A couple of places, in Congaree National Park, one of the amazing rivers, you know, and Congaree changed its name. It used to be Congaree Swamp, but I think they were having a little PR issue because people were like, a swamp? I don't want to go to a swamp. But they changed it to Congaree National Park. And it's actually not a swamp. It's a very slow-moving slough, slough, slough. So it's a very slow current water that's there. But there is this river, the Cedar Creek River, and it's fascinating to me how much humanity needs these spaces, not just now for solace and beauty and to save ourselves, but physically many years ago, to physically be saved. There were a lot of escaped slaves that went into the Congaree National Park and set up their lives. They rebuilt their lives hidden in there. And in the Cedar Creek River, they performed so many baptisms. And when I was kayaking in that creek, all I could think of is, you know, how many baptisms can one river hold? What are the blessings that are in there? And just think of these people who were there amongst all of the river critters, you know, the snakes warming themselves on the branches and the gators and everything. And just to know the history that's there, that the human interaction to our parks is so important. It gives us a place to be saved in our hearts as well as our bodies.
Well, park's full of stories. The whole Mesa Verde Hovenweep area, there's so many stories there. Again, there's a lot. It's not just mysteries, but it's also so many questions about where did all the people go? Why did they leave? It wasn't just the decimation of the resources, but the rangers say historically that there's only ever been one body found. But there were thousands of people who lived in that area. Where did they go? What are the rest of the stories here? Every park has its own set of backstories, you know, about how some people would defend the parks, or some people, you know, like the Hetch Hetchy in this area, John Muir, of course, tried to defend that. But every park has some type of backstory about why it was made into a park, or the people that tried to defend it. But, you know, the Mesa Verde, Hovenweep, Chaco Canyon area, it was just like, there's a lot going on here. I think, and also in terms of like Badlands and the Wind Cave, so much of that area was taken away from the Native Americans because gold was discovered in that area. It's like, okay, there's a whole nother set of questions there. We love finding out those backstories. We always try to do our homework ahead of time, but even when we get to the park, we find out, okay, the story is much deeper than we could ever imagine.
Perfect segue for my penultimate word.
Okay.
Humorous or funny.
I think what was funny to me goes back to Hot Springs. We're there in the park, and they have taken over the old bathhouses from 100 years ago. And one of the bathhouses, the Superior Bathhouse, they turned into a brewery. So Hot Springs National Park is one of the, I think it's the only park that's meant to give away its natural resource, which is the water, because people came there from the early days to be healed. And then the Superior Bathhouse is now the Superior Bathhouse Brewery, and their beer is just fantastic. And one other story with Hot Springs, which I thought was fascinating, was leads back to Babe Ruth. And 100 plus years ago, Hot Springs, was the place of healing. This is before antibiotics. So there were people would come to Hot Springs to quaff the waters, to take in the waters. And it was also because the humanity was going there, the casinos and the nightlife were well set up there. And the famous player, Babe Ruth, came down there, and he enjoyed the casino and the bars a little much and got alcohol poisoning. And the doctors, of course, were there and said, okay, you will have time here. You will take the healing, you will quaff the waters, and then you will, the park is set up to where you exercise after you take the waters in and soak in and drink them, and then you exercise. So that season, Babe Ruth spent his season exercising and went back. And of course, they won the pennant that year. So it caught on. So all the teams started coming down. So all the other teams started coming down. So spring training doesn't refer to the season. It actually refers to hot springs. People would go down there and do their training down in hot springs.
One of the funny and whimsical stories, it's kind of, I guess we could call it whimsical. When we were in the Great Smokies National Park, we found the gravesite for Meriwether Lewis. And Carl and I have a tendency to end up on the roads that nobody else ends up on. and outside the park is the gravesite for Meriwether Lewis. It's about an hour and a half drive. And we got there late at night, and there was nobody else there. I mean, nobody else there. We had to have the headlights on just so we could see the marker. And we climbed out, and we were walking around the marker. And I was trying to get a few pictures with him to flash off the camera, just a few pictures, anything, just to prove we were there. And then while she was busy looking at the marker, I said, okay, you need to keep on talking to the marker, Carla, because I'm seeing some lights rising up from the ground. And we have some live shots of globes of light shooting up from the ground right around the marker, shooting up past your body. And then there's light flashes in the background. There's nobody else there. And it's not lightning because it's all coming up from the ground. And we weren't scared or terrified, but we found out later that the gravesite is considered haunted. And it was absolutely fascinating. We had such a great time, but it was very ethereal almost. So it wasn't so much comedy. It was just more like, wow, that was a much richer experience than I could have ever imagined.
And the last one is a word that's very overused. So I want to be careful how I frame this. The word is awesome. And what I mean by that is a place where you were literally filled with a sense of awe.
Awesome. Black Canyon and the Gunnison. That place, it's not a very large park by comparison to space of the others, but there is this steep canyon that goes straight down and is only 40 feet wide, I believe, at the very bottom section, and it's the Gunnison River. Every year cuts... It rushes, it's furious and awesome, and it cuts a human hair depth out of the earth every year, so it gets deeper and deeper, and there are places in that canyon that the sun never sees because it's so narrow and so tall. It embodies the word awesome.
I tell you, the place, the park that has filled me with the most awe was Wrangell National Park in Alaska. And I say that because the last morning we were in Wrangell, we were at the lodge. And usually at a hotel or a lodge at 11 o'clock in the morning, there's always a bustle of activity. You know, people are checking in and out. And there's usually kids running around and everything else. But at the lodge we were at, there was no one out at 11 o'clock in the morning. And below us, the lodge was up on a mountain. And below us was three rivers in Alaska. And 50 miles away was Mount Drum, covered with snow. And there was nobody there but us. Nobody there but us. And it was a life-changing moment for me. I mean, I'm hoping that everybody's life is full of moments like this. But it was truly a life-changing moment. And I realized... I cannot go back to Texas. I cannot go back to work when I've seen something this soul-filling. And when we went back to Texas, I went to my boss and I said, that's it. That's it. I can't do this anymore. I can't go back to a life of toll roads and lots of traffic and an hour commute to work every day. I said, I can't do it. I've seen too much, and Wrangell has changed me too much. It's formed new wrinkles in my brain. It's redefined wonder for me. And so I arranged a couple of months to just walk away and just devote myself to this project.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Schlum. When we come back after a short break, we'll return to our interview with Texas Poets Laureates Carla Morton and Alan Birkelbach as they tour the national parks. Stay with us. And we're back, and thank you for listening. Let's get back to our interview with Carla Morton and Alan Birkelbach. They are Poets Laureate from Texas on what they're calling Words of Preservation Poets Laureate National Park Tour. They joined us from Mammoth Lakes while touring Yosemite. I saw on your blog that one of your sponsors, I think it is the Pendleton Wool Company, I believe it is, that the Pendleton blankets. Could you tell us a bit about those? Because those are beautiful blankets. And are they associated with the parks?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought up Pendleton Woolen Mills. Yes, you know, they are a sponsor of ours in name. They said, please use our name because they support what we're doing. And those blankets, they have one, not for every park, but they are incredible. And what they gave us, they said, all right, choose a blanket, and which was difficult. Oh my goodness, it was difficult. So the blanket that I chose was the one from Badlands, that dark olive green with the stripes on it. But Pendleton is a huge supporter of the national parks, and they have put us on their blog as well, and put pictures and actually a couple of our poems. They asked if we could give them a couple of poems to post on their blog. And it's just a good working relationship together. We support anyone who supports the parks like that. And we are really honored that they let us use their name in conjunction to what we're doing. So we're very appreciative to them.
And of course, both of you are also photographers, and I think everybody that goes to a national park becomes a photographer. You have to take pictures.
You have to. I mean, and now that everyone's phone does that better than any camera, we're all photographers.
Yes, and I notice you really like to feature that beautiful blanket in many of your photographs.
I do. It's a way to, to give back to Pendleton, but also to, you know, to talk about it. Okay, this is what one company is doing. You know, for everything that they sell, they give a portion back to the parks as well. And you know, this project that we're doing, it's just my little drummer boy gift back to the national parks in any little tiny way or grand way, to support them and to support everyone else who is doing that. They definitely need to go hand in hand.
I'm wondering if you might share a bit of poetry with us, maybe something that you've written recently on your trip.
Yes, this was inspired just from a dream that I had, and I was traveling from Congaree to Glacier National Park, and I just had this cobalt dream. Everything was colored, and it was. It was remarkable, and I knew in Glacier Park, it's in 12 years, only 12 years, all the glaciers will be gone. And that was very worrisome to me. I know it's what happens with the earth, and of course our human involvement doesn't help. But between Congaree and Glacier National Park, my dreams last night ran cobalt. Every bend of knee, every stretch in sheets, a slice of leg through dark waters. The grog, the gruel, the loblolly, the clabbered porridge of swamp, where brown water snakes hang like slow acrobats, curled on low limbs across the waters. My breath held as I paddled beneath. To what purpose, someone asked, is a national park really but a glorified zoo people walk through, a road to nowhere, an afternoon hike, a river traversed a few miles just to turn around and paddle back upstream? I want to ask, have you ever driven the road to the sun? Let your eyes sink in a Montana glacier. What did that do to the unnameable places of your soul? Every question is answered in the wilderness. And when you return in 12 years and the glaciers are gone, what then will your soul do on those hot, dark nights but flail within walls and sit destitute upon concrete and worry where all the white furry beasts go when every ancient patch of snow has melted into green? There you go.
This poem is from the Petrified Forest National Park in Arizona. The Petrified Forest National Park has a little bit of background. It's not a very large park, but the park is covered with the remnants of an old forest where the trees have literally turned to stone. And the Native Americans knew the wonder of this area. And there are several walls down there that are covered with pictographs and petroglyphs, some of which can be deciphered, most of which cannot. And out of that came this poem called Petroglyphs, Petrified Forest. If you think there's not a language here, you're wrong. A heron beaks a startled frog. A panther snarls as it curls its toes. Paneled lines suggest a vast out there. One sleepless concrete night, you'll moan and finally extrapolate that, yes, a gospel can be chipped in stone. Get up then yourself, go. Scratch a picture of yourself pointing up, or running, or leaning on a stick, or holding someone's hand. Make a picture of a path, of a sun that might burn forever. Chip out the best symbol for wonder you can ever imagine.
Wow. I'm curious, when you go on a trip like this, because I know whenever I go somewhere, I really like to research where I'm going and learn a bit about it. How much pre-trip research do you do, or do you just go and let it all unfold when you get there?
Well, that's a great question. You know, Alan is really, really good at the whole research end of it. He finds us great places to stay. He finds us great things to do. And so we both read up on it beforehand and have ideas of the park, but we also like to go and ask the rangers. Just yesterday, here in Yosemite, Ranger Gavin up in Hetch Hetchy, and I said, where is your favorite place to go? And you will be amazed. He sent us to a place that's not on the map. He said it's kind of our own little inspirational point, and it was incredible. And when we were even in Yellowstone, we asked one of the people working there, we said, what's your favorite place? And she said, if you don't see anything else in Yellowstone, go to Lamar Valley. And so I'm looking, going, Lamar Valley was like way down on the list. And I really didn't know anything about it. But it's a combination of, yes, okay, these are the highlights we've read about, but then we always want to know what the Rangers are just incredible. You know, they're there physically doing what we're trying to do with words, but they're out there. They're the muscle making these parks work every day and stay open. And they are incredible. I want to grow up and be a park ranger. I really do. But they are there because they love it. And we really enjoy hearing about their favorite places and trying to go see those as well. And that has never, ever disappointed us.
Was there a ranger that really stands out in your mind and went above and beyond the call for you guys?
Oh, that is such a hard question, because every ranger has been there for us. The one here at Yosemite, Ranger Eric Smith, the one in Glacier, Sonia Hartman. I mean, the ones in the Joshua Tree, the Ranger Karen. She was just incredible. Every single place has outstanding rangers, and I don't want to leave any of them out, because they're so dedicated and they are so incredibly in love with what they do. It is such a beautiful, refreshing thing. You know, they don't make that much money, and yet they're doing it for the love of it.
Cool. Was one park, or can you tell us about one of the parks that was particularly challenging or difficult to get to so far?
Well, of course, the Alaska parks. Getting to Alaska was challenging. We've only been to three. We've got five more to go up there. But the big puzzle right now is the one that we're doing next month. Next month, we are visiting three parks, the two Hawaiian parks, and then the one in Samoa. Now, I believe it's the American, the National Park of the American Samoas. That's the official name. And in order to get to Samoa, you have to fly from Hawaii. And there's only a flight on Tuesdays and Thursdays to get to Samoa, to Pango Pango. And then once you're there, there's a flight only on Thursdays, a little hopper flight that you can only take 11 pounds of luggage, that will take you to a little place called Tau, and then you have to pay Stephen, the fisher boat captain, $200 in cash to take you to Ofu. So it's and there's one place to stay in Ofu, and it's no credit cards, no Wi-Fi, no cell phone. So that will be right now. That's our big challenge in getting to.
Wow, it's a good thing we didn't plan to try to do the interview when you were there.
That's exactly right. There would just be no way. But so that's right now the big puzzle putting together. So we had to start with Samoa and work our way back into the other Hawaiian national parks. So we've been eating a lot of beans lately, because that's a cash only place. So, but that's okay. It's totally worth it.
Well, last question, and give me as brief an answer as you can on this. One of the things with the parks is there's this kind of a catch-22 situation with them. We love them, and because of our visitation, we kind of tend, especially a park like Yosemite that's very popular, we tend to love them to death. At the same time, they're underutilized by a huge section of American society that never gets to set foot in a national park. I'm thinking particularly of people who live in urban areas, people that come from income levels that don't allow for that kind of thing. African Americans underutilize the parks, Hispanic Americans. And that worries me, because it's like they're just as much a part of this country as anybody else, and they probably don't get to experience it as much. Would you like to address that at all?
That is probably the question, Dave. I mean, it's this beauty does belong to all Americans. I've always believed that the national parks are our great cathedrals, and yet there is daily road work and maintenance. Oh my goodness, just the snow removal in parks alone, and the maintenance, it does require an entry fee, and I know not all parks have them. but a lot of parks do, and I think it's a choice also. The parks have these great passes, these year passes that pay for themselves in three visits. And it's not a per person fee. It's a car fee. You know, it's per carload. I think the national parks do an incredible job of bending over backwards to try to make it accessible. And like I said, many parks do not have an entry fee associated with them at all. And this is truly an age old question that I don't have a good answer for, but I know that if we try to visit and contact the parks and be there, that they are working to do their best to make it accessible to all people, and not just Americans. There's a lot of foreign guests that we come across every day. But you're absolutely right. You know, we were in the Great Smoky Mountains, and that place severely is loved to death because I think a third of the United States can access the Great Smoky Mountains, you know, within a day's drive. And they're having that difficult maintenance issue. And how do we love it without loving it to death? That's a question we will continue to work on.
Well, I was also thinking of an experience I had talking to somebody with Nature Bridge, which is a educational foundation that takes kids from inner city areas and all over and exposes them to the parks, like Yosemite especially. And I was remembering a story about a school kid from Oakland, and his whole life, all he'd ever seen is just concrete and fences, and that's it. That's his neighborhood. That was his world. And when he stepped off the bus into Yosemite Valley, it almost like knocked him over, the beauty of it.
Oh, and I have a dear friend, Professor Nicholas Sunstaff, who teaches astrophysics down at Texas A&M University. And he said that the percentage of kids from very large cities, you know, like New York, Chicago, that type of thing, that come, and even in his class, okay, I'm going to say this because he said this, have never even seen the moon, Dave, have never seen the moon. We're in such an extreme nature deficit. And we were made, as humans, we were created to go out and enjoy this nature, but to take care of it. If we take care of nature, nature takes care of us.
Thanks once again to our special guests, Carla K. Morton and Alan Birkelbach. Their tour of the national parks is called Words of Preservation. Both are Poets Laureate from Texas, and they joined us via Skype from Mammoth Lakes near Yosemite National Park in Central California. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in Northern California. Check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe via NPR Podcasts, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow me on Twitter at Dave Shlom. We are distributed through PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.